Now we'll continue our discussion on the latest nuclear arms crisis and also explore why a mother might want to unadopt her child. Joining us today from our New York bureau is E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, and John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy. In Nashville, Tennessee, at Spotland Productions is Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Welcome to you all, and let's turn straight to Korea. John, from what I understand, listening to our correspondent Mike Schuster, there was a period of about 10 years where North Korea didn't make any advances on its nuclear weapons program. Have we failed in the past 6 years to be diplomatic enough as a nation in the United States to give them, I guess, I don't know, a sense of security or a sense of ownership of the diplomatic process?
Well, yes, obviously. The labeling of them as part of the axis of evil and refusing to deal with them directly clearly wasn't the best move because it made them feel that they were perhaps under danger of some sort of attack from us. But we do have to deal with the situation that we have now, and that is that the head of Korea is a canny and confident man, and he considers North Korea to be as much a legitimate place and center of the universe as we consider the United States to be. And at this point, despite the fact that we may wish that we could turn back the clock and have our president not have said what he said, that it's a nasty situation because the only thing that's going to change North Korea's behavior is China, because what puts food on North Korea's table is China. And if they stopped putting food on their table, then in order to eat, the North Korea would shape up. Now, China can make comments now about wanting to participate in economic sanctions and all of these bloodless sorts of diplomatic statements. But unless they are really willing to cut North Korea off, then North Korea is going to continue doing the same thing, which means that as far as I can see it, the only solution here would be for us, the United States, to enact a trade embargo with China to really force their hand. Since we're not going to do that, we now have to sit back and see somebody who is a little bit mentally unhinged having nuclear power. Thank God, apparently, what they set off was not a very effective bomb yet.
Wow, Jeff, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, how do you respond to, I mean, it sounds like John set up a number of scenarios and a number of reasons why they wouldn't work. Do you see a way out of this, Jeff?
It's tough to see a way out of this because everybody finds themselves caught in a conundrum. That Curtis Mayfield song really set the tone because this whole geopolitical conflict can be seen in street terms. And to coin an old hip-hop phrase, it's getting kind of hectic over there. Mm-hmm. And China's outraged. The U.S. is outraged. Everyone's outraged. But China's pushing for those diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis for a number of reasons, including the need to maintain relations with their ally and keeping some relative stability in the area, et cetera. And in any other circumstances, there'd be talk of forceful actions, even possibly military interventions from U.S. or China. But when you add the big stick of nuclear capability and the possibility of that capability into this mix, North Korea becomes the kid on the corner who's been bullied, goes home and gets a gun, and then shows back up on the corner, faces his enemies, raising up his shirt and flashing a weapon and saying, so what's up now? So the walk softly but carry a big stick mantra originally is what has come to mind in the situation. At least that was until yesterday when North Korea has gotten really, really cocky in the war overtures to the U.S. And now they're actually acting like they want to reach for the weapons. So I think everybody finds themselves in a conundrum here. What do you do? A diplomatic relation seems to be the only way out. But then you run the risk of saying, of responding in a way that the U.S. has as a policy not to respond to terrorists, because then everybody will start thinking that they can do the same thing. So they don't want to respond diplomatically and not threaten nuclear and not threaten war, military intervention, because they'll feel that other countries will feel, well, all we have to do is make sure we get a couple of nukes and we'll be respected like North Korea, too.
ER, that's precisely the case now. Yeah. Other nations are talking about arming, and I know that we've seen with India and Pakistan that two countries with longstanding rivalries will both try to arm themselves in order
and
to
Israel
feel secure.
Israel probably has nuclear capabilities, and
Israel
a
does.
Few other places who have not come out and said that. It's a dangerous world out there. We got to start with that. And we're in this position where a lot of those kids on the block who used to be bullied are now saying they're in charge. or at least they don't have to listen to the United States or the United Nations. And we're definitely in trouble when we get that to that point. This is an opportunity, hopefully, for the newest world order, led by the Chinese and maybe the Japanese and others in Asia, to talk to their neighbors about what it is that it takes to exist in this international world. We can talk about sanctions. It's only going to hurt the little man and little woman on the ground. It's not going to hurt any president or prime minister. We can talk about, well, we may have to do the next thing, but does that mean we're going to actually send over some nuclear weapons to take out their weak nuclear weapon? Because that's the story, by the way, that whatever they tested didn't turn out to be much more than a, you know, pop gun or something. So what are we going to do? So we got to get China, Japan, maybe India to step up to the plate and take the lead. And then the U.S. can be back to help in reinforce what they do, but not be the leader in the conversation right now.
Well, I want to move on to another topic, serious, but on a personal level rather than a global level. A Virginia woman is attempting to unadopt her 15-year-old son. She said she learned of his past only after he molested two younger children. Now, she's a 57-year-old foster mother, and she didn't know, she says, how severely damaged this child was. And she says, you don't want to throw somebody away, but sometimes you have to. Basically, no children will be allowed in her house as long as this boy is there. Is this a case of a woman being hard-hearted, or is this a case of the authorities not doing what they should have done, ER?
It's both. Tough love, we know that phrase. So in some ways, she's doing the whole tough love thing in trying to rid him of her life. But mostly, the thing that should matter to those of us who are discussing this issue is, what did the government do, the agencies do, in placing the child in a home? Did they actually live up to their requirements to talk to the potential foster parents about the child's background? That's in dispute. That's what the court case is about. The court case has been around, by the way, for 3 years, it looks like. But that's the issue. Did those agencies who represent us, the people, do their jobs?
But we also, I think that's definitely true. But in this case, the particulars of the case are that this woman has raised many foster children and has even gotten an award for it, which would seem to indicate that she is one for weathering being a new mother to tough cases. You know, foster kids tend not to be angels. They tend to be troubled people. So she's shown that she's up to it. But this seems to have been a particularly problem case. And I think given the benefit to society that she has been in taking in foster kids, who, again, are not like something out of an MGM movie, The Foundling on the Step. These are troubled people. She's done it so much. She's done society such a favor that if there's one who ends up being a sexual predator and prevents other kids from being able to live in the home, then maybe at least morally we can give her a pass on this particular kid. That's my visceral feeling about this one.
Jeff, more not just morally but legally, she's trying to basically get out of a contract. And the kid right now says, I want to stay at home. And he has that right, apparently, unless the court severs the bond. Do you think the court should?
Well, I think it should. First of all, it should investigate to make sure that all of these sides are covered. I think if there was information that was withheld about the child, then I think they should sever that relationship. I think it's wrong to withhold information about foster adoption if that is the case here. Full disclosure of a child's background is a must. because in that situation, you have to be fully aware of what you're getting into. It was an acquaintance I had here who found herself in a similar situation, gung-ho about taking in a 16-year-old. They told her that he had some sexual gender identity problems, but she didn't realize that he was going to come home one day dressed in a prettier dress and higher heels than hers, smarting off almost violently. So she had to end that relationship fairly quickly. But in the Virginia case, Mrs. Briggs still is required to pay child support, which she doesn't want to do. And the kid, who has been labeled a sexual predator, as you said, still wants to be with her. So should she have to pay child support? That's a tough one for me. On the one hand, the kid is troubled, needs assistance wherever he might land, both psychological assistance and financial assistance. But on the other hand, you don't want to feel psychologically that you're supporting a sexual predator, even if he is legally a minor.
You don't even want to feel financially that you have to pay.
Yeah.
Not just psychologically.
I have one last round of questions. We're going to have to go lightning. We've got 3 minutes. Halle Berry's next film is one where she's going to play Tierney Cahill, a teacher from Reno, Nevada, who accepted a challenge from her sixth grade class to run for Congress. The catch is that Cahill is white. Also, Angelina Jolie is going to portray Daniel Pearl's wife, who is a mixed-race French woman. So, you know, you've got Angelina Jolie in these early press photos wearing kind of tan, super tan makeup. And then Halle Berry is not going to be expected to play white, I don't think. But is this an advance, cross-racial casting, or is it just weird?
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful advance. This is what, quote-unquote, getting past race is. And what's interesting is that after the movie comes out with Halle Berry, there are going to be certain people who are going to say that there's something wrong with the fact that she's being made to play a white woman instead of playing one of her own people. And I think that's a shame, because in a society where race really didn't matter anymore, we would see exactly this, black people casually being cast to play whites.
But Halle Berry is a multiracial person, so
she's
intermediate. Not like she could call herself half white or she could call herself half African American.
Not in America.
Yeah, they wouldn't cast Whoopi Goldberg.
No, she can. Is what I'm saying. She can do that. So this is not Dartha Dandridge, you know, having to go through all the trouble she went through trying to act in Hollywood. Miss Berry can do what she wants because she's Miss Berry, and I think we in the media need to get past the whole race card so that we don't make this an issue. If it's a good story, it's a good story.
Not in America. I wasn't trying to pigeonhole Halle Berry. I'm just saying that in general, people who are even faintly African-American are viewed as such.
She ain't faintly. She's half.
Okay. That's what I'm saying.
And perceived usually as more. But as an actor, I'm a purist. I like Shakespeare performed in Shakespearean times, even if it was written with me in mind. As a writer, I'm the same way. I think Raising the Sun is a story that touches universal themes from a perspective of a black family in Chicago in the 50s. It wouldn't work with a multiracial family set on the moon in the year 2075. Now, we've had this. I'm also, as a novice student of history, I'm for historical accuracy, because the universality comes out in the accuracy of the story, too. What does this lay the foundation for? Ben Kingsley played an Indian, Mahatma Gandhi. Will it be okay then in the future for Brad Pitt to play Huey Newton one day?
Yes.
I just believe that, you know, I think that you have to do justice to the historical accuracy, and it makes it even more authentic.
But historical accuracy is not about the color.
We are totally out of time, folks. We're totally out of time. But Brad Pitt as Huey Newton is going to stick in my mind. We've had E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, plus John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Thank you all.
Thank you.
For